Chapter 90. 46 beans to the good. At dawn, Richard Brown was gone. The rest of the men seemed grim but resigned, and under the command of a squatty, morose sort of fellow named Oakes, we resumed our push south. Something had changed in the night. Jamie had lost a little of the tension that had infused him since our departure from the ridge. Stiff, sore, and disheartened as I was, I found this change some comfort, though wondering what had caused it. Was it the same thing that had caused Richard Brown to leave on his mysterious errand? Jamie said nothing, though, beyond inquiring after my hand, which was tender, and so stiff that I couldn't immediately flex my fingers. He continued to keep a watchful eye on our companions, but the lessening of tension had affected them, too. I began to lose my fear that they might suddenly lose patience and string us up, Dom Christie's dour presence notwithstanding. As though in accord with this more relaxed atmosphere, the weather suddenly cleared, which heartened everyone further. It would have been stretching things to say that there was any sense of rapprochement, but without Richard Brown's constant malevolence, the other men at least became occasionally civil. And, as it always did, the tedium and hardship of travel wore everyone down, so that we rolled down the rutted roads like a pack of marbles, occasionally caroming off one another, dusty, silent, and united in exhaustion, if nothing else, by the end of each day. This neutral state of affairs changed abruptly in Brunswick. For a day or two before, Oakes had been plainly anticipating something, and when we reached the first houses, I could see him beginning to draw great breaths of relief. It was therefore no surprise when we stopped to refresh ourselves at a pothouse on the edge of the tiny half-abandoned settlement to find Richard Brown awaiting us. It was a surprise when, without more than a murmured word from Brown, Oakes and two others suddenly seized Jamie, knocking the cup of water from his hand and slamming him against the wall of the building. I dropped my own cup and flung myself toward them, but Richard Brown grabbed my arm in a vice-like grip and dragged me toward the horses. "Let go! What are you doing? Let go, I say!" I kicked him and had a good go at scratching out his eyes, but he got hold of both my wrists and shouted for one of the other men to help. Between the two of them, they got me, still screaming at the top of my lungs, on a horse in front of another of Brown's men. There was a great deal of shouting from Jamie's direction, and general hubbub as a few people came out of a pothouse staring. None of them seemed disposed to interfere with a large group of armed men, though. Tom Christie was shouting protests. I glimpsed him hammering on the back of one man, but to no avail. The man behind me wrapped an arm round my middle and jerked it tight, knocking out what breath I had left. Then we were thundering down the road, Brunswick and Jamie disappearing in the dust. My furious protests, demands, and questions brought no response, of course, beyond an order to be quiet, this accompanied by another warning squeeze of the restraining arm around me. Shaking with rage and terror, I subsided, and at that point saw that Tom Christie was still with us, looking shaken and disturbed. "Tom," I shouted, "Tom, go back. Don't let them kill him, please." He looked in my direction, startled, rose in his stirrups, and looked back toward Brunswick, then turned toward Richard Brown, shouting something. Brown shook his head, reined his mount in so that Christie could come up alongside, and, leaning over, yelled something at him that must have passed for explanation. Christie clearly didn't like the situation, but after a few impassioned exchanges, he subsided, scowling, and dropped back. He pulled his horse's head aside and circled back to come within speaking distance of me. "They will not kill or harm him," he said, raising his voice to be heard over the rumble of hooves and rattle of harness. "Brown's word of honour upon it," he says. "And you believe him, for God's sake?" He looked disconcerted at that, glanced again at Brown, who had spurred up to ride ahead, then back at Brunswick. Indecision played across his features, but then his lips firmed, and he shook his head. "It will be all right," he said. But he wouldn't meet my eyes, and in spite of my continued entreaties to him to go back, to stop them, he slackened his pace, falling back so that I couldn't see him any more. My throat was raw from screaming, and my stomach hurt, bruised and clenched in a knot of fear. Our speed had slowed now that we had left Brunswick behind, and I concentrated on breathing. I wouldn't speak until I was sure I could do so without my voice trembling. "Where are you taking me?" I asked finally. I sat stiff in the saddle, enduring an unwanted intimacy with a man behind me. "New Bern," he said, with a note of grim satisfaction. "And then, thank God, we'll be shut of you at last." The journey to New Bern passed in a blur of fear, agitation, and physical discomfort. While I did wonder what was about to happen to me, all such speculations were drowned by my anxiety about Jamie. Tom Christie was plainly my only hope of finding out anything, but he avoided me, keeping his distance, and I found that as alarming as anything else. He was clearly troubled, even more so than he had been since Mulver's death, but he no longer bore a look of dull suffering. He was actively agitated. I was terribly afraid that he knew or suspected Jamie was dead, but wouldn't admit it, either to me or to himself. All of the men clearly shared my captor's urge to be rid of me as soon as possible. We stopped only briefly when absolutely necessary for the horses to rest. I was offered food, but couldn't eat. By the time we reached New Bern, I was completely drained from the sheer physical exertion of the ride, but much more so from the constant strain of apprehension. Most of the men remained at a tavern on the outskirts of the town. Brown and one of the other men took me through the streets, accompanied by a silent Tom Christie, arriving at last at a large house of whitewashed brick. The home, as Brown informed me with a sense of lively pleasure, of Sheriff Tolliver, also the town jail. The sheriff, a darkly handsome sort, viewed me with a sort of interested speculation, mingling with a growing disgust as he heard the crime of which I was accused. I made no attempt at rebuttal or defence. The room was going in and out of focus, and all my attention was required to keep my knees from giving way. I barely heard most of the exchange between Brown and the sheriff. At the last, though, just before I was led away into the house, I found Tom Christie suddenly beside me. "Mrs. Fraser," he said, very low. "Believe me, he is safe. I would not have his death on my conscience, nor yours." He was looking at me directly for the first time in days, weeks, and I found the intensity of his grey eyes both disconcerting and oddly comforting. "Trust in God," he whispered. "He will deliver the righteous out of all his dangers." And with a sudden, hard and unexpected squeeze of my hand, he was gone. As 18th-century jails went, it could have been worse. The women's quarters consisted of a small room at the back of the sheriff's house, which had likely been a storeroom of sorts originally. The walls were roughly plastered, though some escape-minded former occupant had chipped away a large chunk of the plaster before discovering that beneath it lay a layer of lath, and beneath that an impenetrable wall of baked clay brick, which confronted me at once with its bland impenetrability when the door was opened. There was no window, but an oil dip burned on a ledge by the door, casting a faint circle of light that illuminated the daunting bare patch of brick, but left the corners of the room in deep shadow. I couldn't see the night soil bucket, but knew there was one. The thick, acrid tang of it stung my nose, and I automatically began breathing through my mouth as the sheriff pushed me into the room. The door closed firmly behind me, and a key grated in the lock. There was a single narrow bedstead in the shadows, occupied by a large lump under a threadbare blanket. The lump took its time, but eventually stirred and sat up, resolving itself into a small, plump woman, capless and frowsy with sleep, who sat blinking at me like a dormouse.
"Oh,"
she said, and rubbed her eyes with her fists like a small child. "So sorry to disturb you," I said politely. My heart had slowed a bit by now, though I was still shaking and short of breath. I pressed my hands flat against the door to stop them trembling.
"Think nothing of it,"
she said, and yawned suddenly like a hippopotamus, showing me a set of worn but serviceable molars. Blinking and smacking her lips absently, she reached down beside her, pulled out a battered pair of spectacles, and set them firmly on her nose. Her eyes were blue and hugely magnified by the lenses, enormous with curiosity.
"What's your name?" she asked.
"Claire Fraser," I said, watching her narrowly in case she too might already have heard all about my supposed crime. The bruise on my breast, left by the stone that had struck me, was still visible, beginning to yellow above the edge of my gown.
"Oh."
She squinted, as though trying to place me, but evidently failed, for she shrugged away the effort.
"Got any money?"
"A bit." Jamie had forced me to take almost all the money. Not a great deal, but there was a small weight of coin at the bottom of each of the pockets tied around my waist, and a couple of proclamation notes tucked inside my stays. The woman was a good deal shorter than I, and pillowy in aspect, with large drooping breasts and several comfortable rolls corrugating her uncorseted middle. She was in her shift, with her gown and stays hung from a nail in the wall. She seemed harmless, and I began to breathe a little more easily, beginning to grasp the fact that at least I was safe for the moment, no longer in danger of sudden, random violence. The other prisoner made no offensive moves toward me, but hopped down off the bed, bare feet thumping softly in what I realized now was a matted layer of mouldy straw.
"Well, call the old bism and send for some Holland, then, why don't you?" she suggested cheerfully.
"The who?" Instead of answering, she trundled to the door and banged on it, shouting, "Mrs. Tolliver! Mrs. Tolliver!" The door opened almost immediately, revealing a tall, thin woman looking like an annoyed stork.
"Really, Mrs. Ferguson," she said, "you are the most dreadful nuisance. I was just coming to pay my respects to Mrs. Fraser in any case."
She turned her back on Mrs. Ferguson with magisterial dignity and inclined her head a bare inch toward me.
"Mrs. Fraser,
I am Mrs. Tolliver."
I had a split second in which to decide how to react, and chose the prudent, if galling, course of genteel submission, bowing to her as though she were the governor's lady.
"Mrs. Tolliver,"
I murmured, careful not to meet her eyes.
"How kind of you."
She twitched, sharp-eyed, like a bird spotting the stealthy progress of a worm through the grass. But I had firm control of my features by now, and she relaxed, detecting no sarcasm.
"You are welcome," she said, with chilly courtesy. "I am to see to your welfare and acquaint you with our custom. You will receive one meal each day, unless you wish to send to the ordinary for more, at your own expense. I will bring you a basin for washing once each day. You'll carry your own slops and..."
"Oh, stuff your custom, Maisie," said Mrs. Ferguson, butting into Mrs. Tolliver's set speech with the comfortable assumption of long acquaintance. "She's got some money. Fetch us a bottle of Geneva, there's a good girl. And then, if you must, you can tell her what's what."
Mrs. Tolliver's narrow face tightened in disapproval, but her eyes twitched toward me, bright in the dim light of the rush dip. I ventured a hesitant gesture toward my pocket, and her lower lip sucked in. She glanced over her shoulder, then took a quick step towards me.
"A shilling, then,"
she whispered, hand held open between us. I dropped the coin into her palm, and it disappeared at once beneath her apron.
"You've missed supper,"
she announced in her normal disapproving tones, stepping backward.
"However, as you've just come, I shall make an allowance and bring you something."
"How kind of you," I said again. The door closed firmly behind her, shutting out light and air, and the key turned in the lock. The sound of it set off a tiny spark of panic, and I stamped on it hard. I felt like a dried skin, stuffed to the eyeballs with the tinder of fear, uncertainty, and loss. It would take no more than a spark to ignite that and burn me to ashes, and neither I nor Jamie could afford that.
"She drinks?" I asked, turning back to my new roommate with an assumption of coolness. "Do you know anyone who doesn't, given the chance?" Mrs. Ferguson asked reasonably. She scratched her ribs. "Fraser," she said, "you aren't the..."
"I am," I said, rather rudely. "I don't want to talk about it."
Her eyebrows shot up, but she nodded equably.
"Just as you like," she said. "Any good at cards?"
"Loo or whist?" I asked warily.
"Know a game called Brag?"
"No."
Jamie and Brianna played it now and then, but I had never acquainted myself with the rules.
"That's all right. I'll teach you."
Reaching under the mattress, she pulled out a rather limp deck of pasteboards and fanned them expertly, waving them gently under her nose as she smiled at me.
"Don't tell me," I said. "You're in here for cheating at cards."
"Cheat? Me?
Not a bit of it," she said, evidently unoffended. "Forgery."
Rather to my own surprise, I laughed. I was still feeling shaky, but Mrs. Ferguson was definitely proving a welcome distraction.
"How long have you been in here?" I asked.
She scratched at her head, realized that she wasn't wearing a cap, and turned to pull one out of the rumpled bedding.
"Oh, a month, just about."
Putting on the crumpled cap, she nodded at the doorpost beside me. Turning to look, I saw that it was cross-hatched with dozens of small nicks, some old and dark with dirt, some freshly scratched, showing raw yellow wood. The sight of the marks made my stomach plunge again, but I took a deep breath and turned my back on them.
"Have you had a trial yet?"
She shook her head, light glinting off her spectacles.
"No, praise God. I hear from Maisie that the court shut down. All the justices gone into hiding. Hasn't been anybody tried in the last 2 months."
This was not good news. Evidently the thought showed on my face, for she leaned forward and patted my arm sympathetically.
"I wouldn't be in a hurry, dearie. Not in your shoes, I wouldn't. If they've not tried you, they can't hang you. And while I have met those as say the waiting's like to kill 'em, I've not seen anybody die of it. And I have seen them die at the end of a rope. Nasty business, that is."
She spoke almost negligently, but her own hand rose as though by itself and touched the soft white flesh of her neck. She swallowed, the tiny bump of her Adam's apple bobbing. I swallowed too, an unpleasantly constricted feeling in my own throat.
"But I'm innocent," I said,
wondering even as I said it how I could sound so uncertain.
"Course you are," she said stoutly, giving my arm a squeeze. "You stick to it, dearie. Don't you let them bullywhack you into admitting the least little thing."
"I won't," I assured her dryly.
"One of these days a mob's like to come here," she said, nodding. "String up the sheriff if he don't look sharp. He's not popular, Tolliver."
"I can't imagine why not. A charming fellow like that." I wasn't sure how I felt about the prospect of a mob storming the house. Stringing up Sheriff Tolliver was all very well, so far as that went. But with the memory of the hostile crowds in Salisbury and Hillsborough fresh in mind, I wasn't sure at all that they'd stop with the sheriff. Dying at the hands of a lynch mob wasn't at all preferable to the slower sort of judicial murder I likely faced. Though I supposed there was always a possibility of escaping in the riot.
"And go where, if you did?" I wondered.
With no good answer to that question, I shoved it to the back of my mind and turned my attention back to Mrs. Ferguson, who was still holding out the cards invitingly. "All right," I said, "but not for money."
"Oh, no," Mrs. Ferguson assured me. "Perish the thought. But we must have some sort of stake to make it interesting. We'll play for beans, shall we?"
She set down the cards, and, digging under the pillow, withdrew a small pouch, from which she poured a handful of small white beans.
"Splendid," I said. "And when we're finished, we'll plant them, shall we? And hope for a giant beanstalk to spring up and burst through the roof, so we can escape up it."
She burst into giggles at that, which somehow made me feel very slightly better.
"From your mouth to God's ear, dearie," she said. "I'll deal first, shall I?"
Brag appeared to be a form of poker, and while I had lived with a card sharp long enough to know one when I saw one, Mrs. Ferguson appeared to be playing honestly, for the moment. I was 46 beans to the good by the time Mrs. Tolliver returned. The door opened without ceremony, and she came in, holding a three-legged stool and a chunk of bread. This latter appeared to be both my supper and her ostensible excuse for visiting the cell, for she shoved it at me with a loud, "This will have to keep you till tomorrow, Mrs. Fraser." "Thank you," I said mildly. It was fresh, and appeared to have been hastily dragged through bacon drippings in lieu of butter. I bit into it without hesitation, having sufficiently recovered from shock now as to feel very hungry indeed. Mrs. Tolliver, glancing over her shoulder to be sure the coast was clear, shut the door quietly, put down the stool, and drew a squat bottle from her pocket, blue glass, and filled with some clear liquid. She pulled the cork from it, tilted it, and drank deeply, her long, lean throat moving convulsively. Mrs. Ferguson said nothing, but watched the process with a sort of analytic attention, light glinting from her spectacles, as though comparing Mrs. Tolliver's behaviour with that of previous occasions. Mrs. Tolliver lowered the bottle and stood for a moment grasping it, then handed it abruptly to me and sat down suddenly on the stool, breathing heavily. I wiped the neck of the bottle as inconspicuously as possible on my sleeve, then took a token sip. It was gin, all right, heavily flavoured with juniper berries to hide the poor quality, but powerfully alcoholic. Mrs. Ferguson took a healthy guzzle in her turn, and so we continued, passing the bottle from hand to hand, exchanging small cordialities with it. Her first thirst slaked, Mrs. Tolliver became almost affable, her frosty manner thawing substantially. Even so, I waited until the bottle was nearly empty before asking the question foremost in my mind. "Mrs. Tolliver, the men who brought me, did you happen to hear them say anything about my husband?" She put a fist to her mouth to stifle a belch.
"Say anything?"
"About where he is," I amended. She blinked a little, looking blank.
"I didn't hear," she said, "but I suppose they may have told Tolly."
Mrs. Ferguson handed down the bottle to her. We were sitting side by side on the bed, that being the only place to sit in the small room, nearly falling off the bed in the process.
"Suppose you could ask him, couldn't you, Maisie?" she said.
An uneasy look came into Mrs. Tolliver's eyes, glazed as they were.
"Oh, no," she said, shaking her head. "He doesn't talk to me about such things. Not my business."
I exchanged a glance with Mrs. Ferguson, and she shook her head slightly. "Best not to press the matter now." Worried as I was, I found it difficult to abandon the subject, but plainly there was nothing to be done. I gathered what shreds of patience I had, estimating how many bottles of gin I could afford before my money ran out, and what I might accomplish with them. I lay still that night, breathing the damp, thick air with its scents of mould and urine. I could smell Sadie Ferguson next to me, too, a faint miasma of stale sweat, overlaid with a strong perfume of gin. I tried to close my eyes, but every time I did, small waves of claustrophobia washed over me. I could feel the sweating plaster walls draw closer, and gripped my fists in the cloth of the mattress ticking to keep from throwing myself at the locked door. I had a nasty vision of myself pounding and shrieking, my nails torn and bloody from clawing at the unyielding wood, my cries unheard in the darkness, and no one ever coming. I thought it a distinct possibility. I had heard more from Mrs. Ferguson regarding Sheriff Tolliver's unpopularity. If he were to be attacked and dragged from his home by a mob, or to lose his nerve and run, the chances of him or his wife remembering the prisoners were remote. A mob might find us and kill us in the madness of the moment, or not find us and fire the house. The storeroom was clay brick, but the adjoining kitchen was timber. Damp or not, the place would burn like a torch, leaving nothing but that bloody brick wall standing. I took an especially deep breath, smell notwithstanding, exhaled, and shut my eyes with decision. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. That had been one of Frank's favourite expressions, and by and large a good sentiment. Depends a bit on the day, though, doesn't it? I thought in his direction.
Does it? You tell me.
The thought was there, vivid enough that I might have heard it,
or only imagined it. If I had imagined it, though, I had imagined also a tone of dry amusement that was particularly Frank's.
Fine, I thought, reduced to having philosophical arguments with a ghost. It's been a worse day than I thought. Imagination or not, the thought had succeeded in wrenching my attention off the single-minded track of worry. I felt a sense of invitation, or temptation perhaps, the urge to talk to him, the need to escape into conversation, even if unsided, and imaginary. No, I won't use you that way, I thought, a little sadly. Not right that I should only think of you when I need distraction, and not for your own sake.
And do you never think of me for my own sake?
The question floated in the darkness of my eyelids. I could see his face quite clearly, the lines of it curved in humour, one dark eyebrow raised. I was dimly surprised. It had been so long since I thought of him in any focused way that I should have long since forgotten exactly what he looked like. But I hadn't.
And I suppose that's the answer to your question, then, I thought silently to him.
Good night, Frank. I turned onto my side, facing the door. I felt a little calmer now. I could just make out the outlines of the door, and being able to see it lessened that feeling of being buried alive. I closed my eyes again and tried to concentrate on the processes of my own body. That often helped, bringing me a sense of quiet, listening to the purling of blood through my vessels, and the subterranean gurglings of organs, all carrying peacefully on without the slightest need of my conscious direction. Rather like sitting in the garden, listening to the bees hum in their hives. I stopped that thought in its tracks, feeling my heart jolt in memory, electric as a bee sting. I thought quite fiercely about my heart, the physical organ, its thick, soft chambers and delicate valves. But what I felt was a soreness there. There were hollow places in my heart. Jamie, a gaping, echoing hollow, cold and deep as the crevasse of a glacier. Bree, Jamie, Roger. And Mulva, like a tiny, deep-drilled sore, an ulcer that wouldn't heal. I had managed so far to ignore the rustlings and heavy breathings of my companion. I couldn't ignore the hand that brushed my neck, then slipped down my chest and rested lightly, cupped around my breast. I stopped breathing, then very slowly exhaled. Entirely, without my intent, my breast settled into her cupped palm. I felt a touch on my back, a thumb gently tracing the groove of my spine through my shift. I understood the need of human comfort, the sheer hunger for touch. I had taken it, often, and given it, part of the fragile web of humanity, constantly torn, constantly made anew. But there was that in Sadie Ferguson's touch that spoke of more than simple warmth, or the need of company in the dark. I took hold of her hand, and lifting it from my breast, squeezed the fingers gently shut, and put it firmly away from me, folded back against her own bosom. "No," I said softly. She hesitated,
moved her hips so that her body curved behind me, thighs warm and round against mine, offering encompassment and refuge.
"No one would know," she whispered, still hopeful.
"I could make you forget.
For a bit."
Her hand stroked my hip, gentle, insinuating.
If she could, I thought wryly, I might be tempted. But that pathway wasn't one I could take.
"No," I said, more firmly, and shifted, rolling onto my back as far away as I could get, which was roughly an inch and a half. "I'm sorry, but no."
She was silent for a moment, then sighed heavily.
"Oh, well, perhaps a bit later."
"No!" The noises from the kitchen had ceased, and the house settled into silence. It wasn't the silence of the mountains, though, that cradle of boughs and whispering winds, and the vast deep of the starry sky. It was the silence of a town disturbed by smoke and the fogged dim glow of hearth and candle, filled with slumbering thoughts unleashed from waking reason, roaming and uneasy in the dark.
"Could I hold you?" she asked wistfully, and her fingers brushed my cheek. "Only that?"
"No," I said again, but I reached for her hand and held it. And so we fell asleep, hands chastely and firmly linked between us. We were roused by what I thought at first was the wind moaning in the chimney whose back bulged into our cubbyhole. The moaning grew louder, though, broke into a full-throated scream, then stopped abruptly.
"Ye gods and little fishes!"
Sadie Ferguson sat up, eyes wide and blinking, groping for her spectacles.
"What was that?"
"A woman in labour," I said, having heard that particular pattern of sounds fairly often. The moaning was starting up again, and very near her time. I slid off the bed and shook my shoes, dislodging a small roach and a couple of silverfish who had taken shelter in the toes. We sat for nearly an hour, listening to the alternate moaning and screaming.
"Shouldn't it stop?" Sadie said, swallowing nervously. "Shouldn't the child be birthed by now?"
"Perhaps," I said absently. "Some babies take longer than others." I had my ear pressed to the door, trying to make out what was going on the other side. The woman, whoever she was in the kitchen, and no more than 10 feet away from me. I heard Maisie Tolliver's voice now and then, muffled and sounding doubtful. But for the most part, only the rhythmic panting, moaning, and screaming. Another hour of it, and my nerves were becoming frayed. Sadie was on the bed, the pillow pressed down hard over her head in hopes of blocking the noise.
"Enough of this," I thought, and when next I heard Mrs. Tolliver's voice, I banged on the door with the heel of my shoe, shouting, "Mrs. Tolliver!" as loudly as I could to be heard over the noise.
She did hear me, and after a moment, the key grated in the lock, and a wave of light and air fell into the cell. I was momentarily blinded by the daylight, but blinked and made out the shape of a woman on her hands and knees by the hearth facing me. She was black, bathed in sweat, and, raising her head, howled like a wolf. Mrs. Tolliver started as though someone had run a pin into her from behind.
"Excuse me," I said, pushing past her.
She made no move to stop me, and I caught a strong blast of juniper-scented gin fumes as I brushed by her. The black woman sank down on her elbows, panting, her uncovered rear in the air. Her belly hung like a ripe guava, pale in the sweat-soaked shift that clung to it. I asked sharp questions in the brief interval before the next howl, and ascertained that this was her fourth child, and that she had been labouring since her water had broken the night before. Mrs. Tolliver contributed the information that she was also a prisoner and a slave. I might have guessed that from the purplish wheels on her back and buttocks. Mrs. Tolliver was of little other use, swaying glassy-eyed over me, but had managed to provide a small pile of rags and a basin of water, which I used to mop the woman's sweating face. Sadie Ferguson poked her bespectacled nose cautiously out of the cell, but drew back hastily when the next howl broke forth. It was a breech birth, which accounted for the difficulty, and the next quarter hour was hair-raising for all concerned. At length, though,
I eased a small baby into the world, feet first, slimy, motionless, and the most unearthly shade of pale blue.
"Oh," said Mrs. Tolliver, sounding disappointed, "it's dead."
"Good," said the mother, in a hoarse, deep voice, and closed her eyes.
"Damned if he is," I said,
and turned the child hastily face down, tapping its back. No movement, and I brought the sealed, waxy face to my own, covered nose and mouth with my own mouth, and sucked hard, then turned my head to spit away the mucus and fluid. Face slimy and the taste of silver in my mouth, I blew gently into him, paused, holding him limp and slippery as a fresh fish, blue, and saw his eyes open, a deeper blue than his skin, vaguely interested. He took a startled, gasping breath, and I laughed, a sudden wellspring of joy bubbling up from my depths. The nightmare memory of another child, a flicker of life blinking out between my hand, faded away. This child was well and truly lit, burning like a candle with a soft, clear flame.
"Oh," said Mrs. Tolliver again.
She leaned forward to look, and an enormous smile spread across her face.
"Oh, oh."
The baby started crying. I cut the cord, wrapped him in some of the rags, and with some reservation handed him to Mrs. Tolliver, hoping she wouldn't drop him in the fire. Then I turned my attention to the mother, who was drinking thirstily from the basin, water spilling down her front and soaking the already wet shift further. She lay back and allowed me to tend her, but without speaking, rolling her eyes occasionally toward the child with a brooding, hostile look. I heard footsteps coming through the house, and the sheriff appeared, looking surprised.
"Oh, Tolly."
Mrs. Tolliver, smeared with birth fluids and reeking of gin, turned to him happily, holding out the baby to him.
"Look, Tolly, it's alive."
The sheriff looked quite taken aback, and his brow furrowed as he looked at his wife. But then he seemed to catch the scent of her happiness above the gin. He leaned forward and touched the little bundle gently, his stern face relaxing.
"That's good, Maisie," he said. "Hello, little fellow."
He caught sight of me then, kneeling on the hearth, doing my best to clean up with a rag and what was left of the water.
"Mrs. Fraser brought the child," Mrs. Tolliver explained eagerly. "It was laid cattywampus, but she brought it so cleverly and made it breathe. We thought 'twas dead, it was so still, but it wasn't. Isn't that wonderful, Tolly?"
"Wonderful," the sheriff repeated, a little bleakly.
He gave me a hard look, then transferred the same look to the new mother, who gazed back with a sullen indifference. He beckoned me to my feet then, and with a curt bow, gestured me back into the cell and shut the door. Only then did I recall what it was he thought I'd done. Little wonder if my juxtaposition with a newborn child made him a trifle nervous, I supposed. I was wet and filthy, and the cell seemed particularly hot and airless. Nonetheless, the miracle of birth was still tingling through my synapses, and I sat down on the bed, still smiling, a wet rag in my hand. Sadie was regarding me with respect, mingled with a slight revulsion.
"That's the messiest business I ever did see," she said. "Heavens above, is it always like that?"
"More or less. Haven't you ever seen a child born?"
"You've never had one yourself?" I asked curiously.
She shook her head vigorously and made the sign of the horns, which made me laugh, giddy as I was.
"Had I ever been disposed to let a man near me? The thought of that would dissuade me," she assured me fervently.
"Oh, yes," I said, belatedly recalling her overtures of the night before.
It wasn't merely comfort she'd been offering then.
"And what about Mr. Ferguson?" She gave me a demure look, blinking through her spectacles.
"Oh, he was a farmer, much older than I. Dead of the pleurisy, these 5 years gone."
And totally fictitious, I was inclined to think. But a widow had a great deal more freedom than did a maid or a wife. And if ever I saw a woman capable of taking care of herself... I'd been paying no attention to the sounds in the kitchen, but at this point
there was a heavy crash, and Vashera's voice cursing. No sound of the child or Mrs. Tolliver.
"Taking the black bitch back to her quarters," Sadie said, with such a hostile intonation that I glanced at her in amazement. "Didn't you know?" she said, seeing my surprise. "She's killed her babies. They can hang her, now she's born this one."
"Oh," I said, a little blankly.
"No, I didn't know."
The noises in the kitchen receded, and I sat staring at the rush dip, the sense of life still moving in my hands. Chapter 91. A Reasonably Neat Scheme. Water lapped just under Jamie's ear, the mere sound of it making him feel queasy. The reek of decaying mud and dead fish didn't help, nor did the dunt he'd taken when he fell against the wall. He shifted, trying to find some position that would ease head, stomach, or both. They'd trussed him like a boiled fowl, but he managed with some effort to roll onto his side and bring his knees up, which helped a bit. He was in a dilapidated boat shed of some sort. He'd seen it in the last of the twilight when they'd brought him down to the shore. He'd thought at first they meant to drown him, and carried him inside, dropping him on the floor like a sack of flour.
"Hurry up, Ian," he muttered, shifting again in increasing discomfort. "I'm a great deal too old for this sort of nonsense."
He could only hope his nephew had been close enough when Brown moved to have been able to follow and to have some notion where he was now. Certainly the lad would be looking. The shore, where the shed stood, was open. No cover, but there was plenty among the brush below Fort Johnston, standing on the headland a little way above him. The back of his head throbbed dully, giving him a nasty taste in the back of the mouth, and a disquieting echo of the shattering headaches he used to suffer in the wake of an axe wound that had cracked his skull many years before. He was shocked at how easily the recollection of those headaches came back. It had happened a lifetime ago, and he had thought even the memory of it dead and buried. His skull clearly had a much more vivid memory of its own, though, and was determined to make him sick by way of revenge for his forgetfulness. The moon was up and bright. The light shone soft through the cracks between the crude boards of the wall. Dim as it was, it seemed to shift, wavering in a disturbingly qualmish fashion. And he shut his eyes, concentrating grimly on what he might do to Richard Brown, and he got the man alone some day. Where in the name of Michael and all the saints had he taken Claire, and why? Jamie's only comfort was that Tom Christie had gone with them. He was fairly sure that Christie wouldn't let them kill her, and if Jamie could find him, he would lead him to her. A sound reached him above the nauseating lapping of the tide, faint whistling, then singing. He could just make out the words and smiled a little in spite of everything.
Marry me, minister, or else I'll be your priest, or else I'll be your priest.
He shouted, though it hurt his head, and within a few moments Ian, the dear wee lad, was beside him, cutting through the ropes. He rolled over, unable for a moment to make his cramped muscles work, then managed to get his hands under him and rise enough to vomit.
"All right, Uncle Jimmy."
Ian sounded vaguely amused, damn him.
"I'll do. Do you ken where Claire is?"
He got to his feet, swaying, and was fumbling at his breeches. His fingers felt like sausages, and the broken one was throbbing, the pins and needles of returning circulation stabbing through the jagged ends of bone. All discomfort was forgotten for an instant, though, in the rush of overwhelming relief.
"Jesus, Uncle Jimmy," Ian said, impressed. "Aye, I do. They've taken her to New Bern. There's a sheriff there that Forbes says might take her."
"Forbes?" He swung round in his astonishment and nearly fell, saving himself with a hand on the creaking wood wall.
"Neil Forbes?" "The very same."
Ian caught him with a hand beneath his elbow to steady him. The flimsy board had cracked under his weight.
"Brown went here and there and talked to this one and that, but it was Forbes he did business with, at last, in Cross Creek." "You heard what they said?"
I heard.
Ian's voice was casual, but with an underlying excitement, and no little pride in his accomplishment. Brown's aim was simple at this point, to rid himself of the encumbrance the Frasers had become. He knew of Forbes and his relations with Jamie, owing to all the gossip after the tar incident in the summer of last year, and the confrontation at Mecklenburg in May. And so he offered to hand the two of them over to Forbes for what use the lawyer might make of the situation.
So he strode to and fro a bit, thinking, Forbes, I mean. They were in his warehouse again by the river, and me hiding behind the barrels of tar. And then he laughs, as though he's just thought of something clever.
Forbes' suggestion was that Brown's men should take Jamie, suitably bound, to a small landing that he owned near Brunswick. From there, he would be taken onto a ship headed for England, and thus safely removed from interference in the affairs of either Forbes or Brown, and, incidentally, rendered unable to defend his wife. Claire, meanwhile, should be committed to the mercies of the law. If she were to be found guilty, well, that would be the end of her. If not, the scandal attendant upon a trial would both occupy the attention of anyone connected to her and destroy any influence they might have, thus leaving Fraser's Ridge ripe for the pickings, and Neil Forbes a clear field toward claiming leadership of the Scottish Whigs in the colony. Jamie listened to this in silence, torn between anger and a reluctant admiration.
"A reasonably neat scheme," he said.
He was feeling steadier now, the queasiness disappearing with the cleansing flow of anger through his blood.
"Oh, it gets better, Uncle," Ian assured him. "You recall a gentleman named Stephen Bonnet?"
"I do."
"It's Mr. Bonnet's ship, Uncle, that's to take you to England."
Amusement was beginning to show in his nephew's voice again.
"It seems Lawyer Forbes has a very profitable partnership with Bonnet for some time. Him and some merchant friends in Wilmington. They've shares in both the ships and its cargoes. And since the English blockade, the profits have been greater still. I take it that our Mr. Bonnet is a most experienced smuggler."
Jamie said something extremely foul in French and went quickly to look out of the shed. The water lay calm and beautiful, a moon path stretching silver out to sea. There was a ship out there, small and black, and perfect as a spider on a sheet of paper. Bonnets.
"Christ," he said. "When will they come in, do you think?"
"I dinna ken," Ian said, sounding unsure for the first time.
"Is the tide coming in, would you say, Uncle? Or going out?"
Jamie glanced down at the water rippling under the boathouse as though it might offer some clue.
"How would I know, for God's sake? And what difference would it make?"
He rubbed a hand hard over his face, trying to think. They'd taken his dirk, of course. He had a ski-in-do carried in his stocking, but somehow doubted that its 3-inch blade would offer much help in the present situation.
"What have you got by way of weapons, Ian? You dinna have your bow with you, I don't suppose?"
Ian shook his head regretfully. He had joined Jamie in the door of the boathouse, and the moon showed the hunger in his face as he eyed the ship.
"I've 2 decent knives, a dirk, and a pistol. There's my rifle, but I left it with the horse."
He jerked his head toward the dark line of the distant wood.
"Shall I fetch it? They might see me."
Jamie thought for a moment, tapping his fingers against the jamb of the door, till the pain of the broken one made him stop. The urge to lie in wait for Bonnet and take him was a physical thing. He understood Ian's hunger and shared it. But his rational mind was busy reckoning the odds and would insist upon presenting them, little as the vengefully animal part of him wished to know them. There wasn't yet any sign of a boat coming from the ship, always assuming that the ship out there was indeed Bonnet's, and that they didn't know for sure. It might still be hours before anyone came to fetch him away. And when they did, what odds that Bonnet himself would come? He was the ship's captain. Would he come on such an errand, or send minions? With a rifle, if Bonnet were in the boat, Jamie would wager any amount that he could shoot the man from ambush. If he were in the boat, if he were recognizable in the dark.
and while he could hit him, he might not kill him. If Bonnet were not in the boat, though, then it would be a matter of waiting till the boat came close enough, leaping aboard and overpowering whoever was aboard. And how many would come on such an errand? 2, 3, 4? They must all be killed or disabled, and then it would be a matter of rowing the damn boat back out to the ship, where all aboard would doubtless have noticed the skirmish taking place on shore, and be prepared either to drop a cannonball through the bottom of the boat, or to wait for them to haul alongside, and then pick them off from the rail with small arms fire like sitting ducks. And if they should somehow succeed in getting aboard without notice, then searching the goddamn ship for Bonnet himself, hunting him down and killing him without attracting undue notice from the crew. This laborious analysis ran through his mind in the time it took to breathe, and was as quickly dismissed. If they were to be captured or killed, Claire would be alone and defenceless. He couldn't risk it. Still, he thought, trying to comfort himself, he could find Forbes, and would, when the time came. "Aye, well then," he said, and turned away with a sigh. "Have you but the one horse, Ian?" "Aye," Ian said, with a matching sigh. "But I ken where we can maybe steal another." Chapter 92. Amanuensis. 2 days passed, hot, damp days in the sweltering dark, and I could feel various kinds of mould, fungus and rot trying to take hold in my crevices, to say nothing of the omnivorous, omnipresent cockroaches, who seemed determined to nibble my eyebrows the moment the light was put out. The leather of my shoes was clammy and limp, my hair hung lank and dirty, and, like Sadie Ferguson, I took to spending most of my time in my shift. When Mrs. Tolliver appeared and ordered us to come assist with the washing, therefore, we abandoned the latest game of loo she was winning, and nearly pushed each other over in our haste to oblige. It was much hotter in the yard, with the laundry fire roaring, and quite as damp as it had been in the cell, with the thick clouds of moisture boiling off the big kettle of clothes and plastering strands of hair to our faces. Our shifts already clung to our bodies, the grubby linen almost transparent with sweat. Laundry was heavy work. There were, however, no bugs, and if the sun shone blindingly and fierce enough to redden my nose and arms, well, it shone, and that was something to be grateful for. I asked Mrs. Tolliver about my erstwhile patient and her child, but she merely pressed her lips tight and shook her head, looking pinched and severe. The sheriff had been absent the night before. There had been no sound of his booming voice in the kitchen. And from the green-gilled looks of Maisie Tolliver herself, I diagnosed a long and solitary night with the gin bottle, followed by a fairly ghastly dawn. "You'll feel much better if you sit in the shade and sip water," I said. "Lots of water." Tea or coffee would be better, but these substances were more costly than gold in the colony, and I doubted a sheriff's wife would have any. "If you have any ipecacuanha, or perhaps some mint." "I thank you for your valuable opinion, Mrs. Fraser," she snapped, though she swayed rather, and her cheeks were pale and glossy with sweat. I shrugged, and bent my attention to the task of levering a wad of sopping, steaming clothes from the filthy suds with a 5-foot wooden laundry spoon, so worn with use that my sweaty hands slipped on the smooth wood. We got the lot laboriously washed, rinsed, scaldingly wrung, and hung upon a line to dry, then sank gasping into the thin line of shade afforded by the side of the house, and took turns passing a tin dipper back and forth, gulping lukewarm water from the well bucket. Mrs. Tolliver, disregarding her elevated social position, sat down too, very suddenly. I turned to offer her the dipper, only to see her eyes roll back into her head. She didn't so much fall as dissolve backward, subsiding slowly into a heap of damp, checked gingham. "Is she dead?" Sadie Ferguson inquired with interest. She glanced to and fro, obviously estimating the chances of making a run for it. "No. Bad hangover. possibly aggravated by a slight case of sunstroke. I got hold of her pulse, which was light and fast, but quite steady.
I was myself debating the wisdom of abandoning Mrs. Tolliver to the dangers of aspirating her own vomit and absconding, even barefoot and in my shift, but was forestalled by male voices coming round the corner of the house. Two men, one was Tolliver's constable, whom I'd seen briefly when Brown's men had delivered me to the jail. The other was a stranger, very well dressed, with silver coat buttons and a silk waistcoat, rather the worse for sweat stains. This gentleman, a heavy-set sort of about 40, frowned at the scene of dissipation before him.
"Are these the prisoners?" he asked in tones of distaste.
"Aye, sir," the constable said. "Leastwise, the two in their shifts is. T'other one's the sheriff's wife."
Silver Button's nostrils pinched in briefly in receipt of this intelligence, then flared.
"Which is the midwife?"
"That would be me," I said, straightening up and trying for an air of dignity. "I am Mrs. Fraser."
"Are you?"
he said, his tone indicating that I might have said I was Queen Charlotte, for all it mattered to him. He looked me up and down in a disparaging fashion, shook his head, then turned to the sweating constable.
"What is she charged with?"
The constable, a rather dim young man, pursed his lips at this, looking dubiously back and forth between us.
"Ah, well, one of 'em's a forger," he said, "and t'other is a murderess. But as to which being which..." "I'm the murderess," Sadie said bravely, adding loyally, "She's a very fine midwife."
I looked at her in surprise, but she shook her head slightly and compressed her lips, adjuring me to keep quiet.
"Oh, All right, then. Have you a gown, madam?"
At my nod, he said briefly,
"Get dressed,"
and turned to the constable, taking out a vast silk handkerchief from his pocket, with which to wipe his broad pink face.
"I'll take her, then. You'll tell Mr. Tolliver."
"I will, sir,"
the constable assured him, more or less bowing and scraping. He glanced down at the unconscious form of Mrs. Tolliver, then frowned at Sadie.
"You there. Take her inside and see to her. Hop."
"Oh, yes, sir,"
Sadie said, and gravely pushed up her sweat-fogged spectacles with one forefinger.
"Right away, sir."
I had no opportunity to speak with Sadie, and barely time enough to struggle into my bedraggled gown and stays and seize my small bag before being escorted into a carriage. Rather bedraggled itself, but once of good quality. "Would you mind telling me who you are and where you're taking me?" I inquired, after we had rattled through two or three cross streets, my companion gazing out the window with an abstracted sort of frown. My question roused him, and he blinked at me, only then seeming to realise that I was not, in fact, an inanimate object.
"Oh, beg pardon, madam. We are going to the governor's palace. Have you not a cap?"
"No." He grimaced, as though he'd expected nothing else, and resumed his private thoughts. They'd finished the place, and very nicely too. William Tryon, the previous governor, had built the governor's palace, but had been sent to New York before construction had been finished. Now the enormous brick edifice, with its graceful spreading wings, was complete, even to the lawns and ivy beds that lined the drive, though the stately trees that would eventually surround it were mere saplings. The carriage pulled up on the drive, but we did not, of course, enter by the imposing front entrance, but rather scuttled round the back and down the stairs to the servants' quarters in the basement. Here I was hastily shoved into a maid's room, handed a comb, basin and ewer, and a borrowed cap, and urged to make myself look less like a slattern as quickly as possible. My guide, Mr. Webb was his name, as I learned from the cook's respectful greeting to him, waited with obvious impatience while I made my hasty ablutions, then grasped my arm and urged me upstairs. We ascended by a narrow back stair to the second floor, where a very young and frightened-looking maidservant was waiting.
"Oh, you've come, sir, at last."
She bobbed a curtsy to Mr. Webb, giving me a curious glance.
"Is this the midwife?"
"Yes, Mrs. Fraser, Dillman."
He nodded at the girl, giving only her surname, the English fashion for house servants. She curtsied to me in turn, then beckoned me toward a door that stood ajar. The room was large and gracious, furnished with a canopied bed, a walnut commode, armoire, and armchair, though the air of elegant refinement was somewhat impaired by a heap of mending, a ratty sewing basket overturned and spilling its threads, and a basket of children's toys. In the bed was a large mound, which, given the evidence to hand, I rather supposed must be Mrs. Martin, the governor's wife. This proved to be the case when Dillman curtsied again, murmuring my name to her. She was round, very round, given her advanced state of pregnancy, with a small sharp nose and a near-sighted way of peering that reminded me irresistibly of Beatrix Potter's Mrs. Tiggywinkle. In terms of personality, not quite so much. "Who the devil is this?" she demanded, poking a frowsy, capped head out of the bedclothes. "Midwife, mum," Dillman said, bobbing again. "Have you slept well, mum?" "Of course not," Mrs. Martin said crossly. "This beastly child's kicked my liver black and blue. I've puked all night. I've sweated through my sheets. And I have a shaking ague. I was told there was no midwife to be found within the county." She gave me a dyspeptic look. "Where did you discover this person? The local prison?" "Actually, yes," I said, unslinging my bag from my shoulder. "How far gone are you? How long have you been ill? And when's the last time you moved your bowels?" She looked marginally more interested and waved Dillman out of the room. "What did you say your name was?" "Fraser. Are you experiencing any symptoms of early labour? Cramping, bleeding, intermittent pain in the back?" She gave me a sideways look, but did eventually begin to answer my questions, from which, in the fullness of time, I eventually was able to diagnose an acute case of food poisoning, likely caused by a leftover slice of oyster pie, consumed with quite a lot of other edibles, in a fit of pregnancy-induced greed the day before. "I have not an ague." She withdrew the tongue she had allowed me to inspect, frowning. "You have not. Not yet, anyway," honesty compelled me to add. It was no wonder she thought she had. I had learned, in the course of the examination, that a particularly virulent sort of fever was abroad in the town, and in the palace. The governor's secretary had died of it 2 days before, and Dillman was the only upstairs servant still on her feet. I got her out of bed, and helped her to the armchair, where she subsided, looking like a squashed cream cake. The room was hot and stuffy, and I opened the window in hopes of a breeze.
"God's teeth, Mrs. Fraser! Do you mean to kill me?"
She clutched her wrapper tight around her belly, hunching her shoulders as though I had admitted a howling blizzard. "Probably not."
"But the miasma!"
She waved a hand at the window, scandalized. In all truth, mosquitoes were a danger, but it was still several hours till sunset when they would begin to rise.
"We'll close it in a bit. For the moment, you need air, and possibly something light. Could you stomach a bit of dry toast, do you think?"
She thought that one over, tasting the corners of her mouth with a tentative tongue tip.
"Perhaps," she decided. "And a cup of tea. Dillman!"
Dillman dismissed to fetch the tea and toast. How long was it since I had even seen real tea, I wondered. I settled down to make a more complete medical history. How many earlier pregnancies? 6. But a shadow crossed her face, and I saw her glance involuntarily at a wooden puppet lying near the hearth. "Are your children in the palace?" I asked, curious. I had heard no sign of any children, and even in a place the size of the palace it would be difficult to hide 6 of them. "No," she said with a sigh, and put her hands on her belly, holding it almost absently. "We sent the girls to my sister in New Jersey a few weeks ago." A few more questions, and the tea and toast arrived. I left her to eat it in peace, and went to shake out the damp, crumpled bedclothes.
"Is it true?" Mrs. Martin asked suddenly, startling me.
"Is what true?"
"They say you murdered your husband's pregnant young mistress and cut the baby from her womb. Did you?"
I put the heel of my hand against my brow and pressed, closing my eyes. How on earth had she heard that? When I thought I could speak, I lowered my hands and opened my eyes. She wasn't his mistress, and I didn't kill her. As for the rest, yes, I did, I said, as calmly as I could. She stared at me for a moment, her mouth hanging open. Then she shut it with a snap and crossed her forearms over her belly. "Trust George Webb to choose me a proper midwife," she said, and, much to my surprise, began to laugh. "He doesn't know, does he?" "I would assume not," I said, with extreme dryness. "I didn't tell him."
"Who told you?" "Oh, you are quite notorious, Mrs. Fraser," she assured me. "Everyone has been talking of it. George has no time for gossip, but even he must have heard of it. He has no memory for names, though. I do."
A little colour was coming back into her face. She took another nibble of toast, chewed, and swallowed gingerly.
"I wasn't sure that it was you, though," she admitted. "Not until I asked."
She closed her eyes, grimacing doubtfully, but evidently the toast hit bottom, for she opened them and resumed her nibbling.
"So now that you do know?" I asked delicately. "I don't know. I've never known a murderess before."
She swallowed the last of the toast and licked the tips of her fingers before wiping them on the napkin. "I am not a murderess," I said.
"Well, of course, you'd say so," she agreed.
She took up the cup of tea, surveying me over it with interest.
"You don't look depraved, though I must say you don't look quite respectable either."
She raised the fragrant cup and drank, with a look of bliss that made me conscious that I hadn't eaten anything since the rather meagre bowl of unsalted, unbuttered porridge provided for breakfast by Mrs. Tolliver.
"I'll have to think about it," Mrs. Martin said, setting down her cup with a clink. "Take that back to the kitchen," she said, waving at the tray, "and have them send me up some soup, and perhaps a few sandwiches. I do believe my appetite has come back."
Well, now bloody what? I'd been whisked so abruptly from jail to palace that I felt like a sailor decanted onto land after months at sea, staggering and off balance. I went obediently down to the kitchen, as instructed, obtained a tray with a most delectable-smelling bowl of soup, and took it back to Mrs. Martin, walking like an automaton. By the time she dismissed me, my brain had begun to function again, if not yet at full capacity. I was in New Bern, and thanks be to God and Sadie Ferguson, out of Sheriff Tolliver's noisome jail. Ferguson Marsali were in New Bern, ergo, the obvious, in fact, the only thing to do was plainly to escape and find my way to them. They could help me to find Jamie. I clung firmly to Tom Christie's promise that Jamie wasn't dead, and to the notion that he was findable, because nothing else was tolerable. Escaping from the governor's palace, though, proved more difficult than I had anticipated. There were guards posted at all the doors, and my attempt to talk my way past one of them failed utterly, leading to the abrupt appearance of Mr. Webb, who took me by the arm and escorted me firmly up the stairs to a hot, stuffy little garret, where he locked me in. It was better than the jail, but that was all that could be said for it. There was a cot, a chamber pot, a basin, ewer, and chest of drawers, the latter containing meagre bits of clothing. The room showed signs of recent occupancy, but not immediately recent. A film of fine summer dust lay over everything, and while the ewer was full of water, it had obviously been there for some time, a number of moths and other small insects had drowned in it, and a film of the same fine dust floated on the surface. There was also a small window, painted shut, but determined banging and heaving got it open, and I breathed a heady lungful of hot, muggy air. I stripped off, removed the dead moths from the pitcher, and washed. A blissful experience that made me feel immensely better after the last week of unalloyed grime, sweat, and filth. After a moment's hesitation, I helped myself to a worn linen shift from the chest of drawers, unable to bear the thought of putting my own filthy, sweat-soaked chemise back on. I could do only so much without soap or shampoo, but even so, felt much improved, and stood by the window combing out my wet hair. There'd been a wooden comb on the chest, though no looking-glass, and surveying what I could see from my perch. There were more guards posted round the edge of the property. Was that usual? I wondered. I thought perhaps it was not. They seemed uneasy and very alert. I saw one challenge a man who approached the gate, presenting his weapon in rather belligerent fashion. The man seemed startled and backed up, then turned and walked away fast, glancing backward as he went. There were a number of uniformed guards. I thought they were perhaps marines, though I wasn't sufficiently familiar with uniforms as to be sure of it, clustered round six cannon, these situated on a slight rise before the palace, commanding the town and the harbour's edge. There were two non-uniformed